English, and that was not neither up. So I will attempt. Thank you.
Okay. Interesting.
I'll attempt to show you some very interesting slides with what amounts to an English commentary and spoken with a Scottish accent, which might make it all very much easier. The English have difficulty, as you know, in understanding the Scots. Not just their language, but their way of thinking. Anyway, I am now going to show you something which is basically the documentation of a journey that has taken place in some shape or form for the last 6 years, and which has now reached the point of lasting for over 70 days and takes in about 7,500 miles. I don't know very much about the journey, but I've been on the journey 6 times. It is always a surprise to me, and it's never the same journey. There is no beginning and no end, and there's no periphery. The journey is inspired by most of the artists I've had to deal with in my life, who, if you like, are the true teachers of our time. And I can talk about people like Joseph Beuys and Tadeusz Kantor, but I think I should, because Mr. Sandberg is here, say that I used to begin my lecture by quoting what he once said in a catalogue, which was that those who are calling themselves experts as gallery directors or critics should remember always that they have to pay respect to the artist as the person who says or who defines the truth, first of all. And we can only listen very carefully and pay great attention, because we could make many mistakes. And so I'm asking you to consider how this journey formed itself almost independently of my own philosophy. My gallery has put on far too many exhibitions, over 700. I can't remember them all, that's far too many. I happen to think that we live in a very exciting time in which we have the power to transform the world, and at the same time we have the power, perhaps for the first time, to destroy it. So we are becoming like gods, and even those of us who are not creative have the power, literally, which is beyond human nature. Anyway, I'm going to show you what in fact is a journey around the summer solstice, which is investigating the origins of European culture. The journey is not about just the contemporary art world, which I think could be a prison. It's not just about artists. It's certainly not about the Documenta or the Venice Biennale or what goes on nowadays in most museums. Maybe it's a time out of making art. Maybe it's a retreat from making art. Maybe there is too much art. Maybe after tourism, art is the most dangerous form of pollution that we have. Maybe every new art school and every new art center makes it more difficult for the true artist to say what he or she must say. So the journey is an examination of that space which is not about past or present or future. It is the space in which the artist works, which is timelessness. It's a continuum. And so you will see many different things. But first of all, you will see the city of Edinburgh, where the journey begins and ends. A city of great beauty, totally mysterious, and 20,000 miles north of London. It is a city where the spirit of King Arthur still controls things, because the city centre is defined by a mountain, a volcanic mountain called the Seat of Arthur, and nobody knows why. Thank heaven. Anyway, here we go. We put our minds to these slides. This is downtown Edinburgh, as the Americans say, the very heart and centre of the city. It is such a beautiful and amazing place that it inspired Rudolf Bing at the end of the war to make it the centre for the world's most important festival of the arts. I don't think there has ever been at the festival any music, any drama, or any exhibition to compare to the visual splendour of the city itself. This point where I am standing taking the photograph at nearly midnight on midsummer is the top of a volcano. It is the mountain which is the sacred mountain of Arthur. It is an old, extraordinary place of human habitation which is older than history. The festival has never been able to relate to that space. It defies, if you like, most of the activities of whatever we call artists. There is the castle in the middle ground, crowning another important hill. There are seven hills. There is an estuary of the River Forth, and it was here that the ships of the Scottish merchantmen plied their trade with Holland and the Low Countries and France at that time, when there was a very close cultural relationship between Scotland and this part of the world where we are now. And to show you how important this is, I ask you to look at this. It's one of the finest pieces of architecture that I could ever consider, and it's a proof positive that there is no such thing as progress in art. Art doesn't get better. Now, what a very reassuring thought. You mean to say that 20th century art isn't better than 18th century art, and 18th century art isn't better than 13th century art? And this extraordinary work is probably a very, very early example of Charles Rennie Mackintosh. In fact, it's a 16th century example of Charles Rennie Mackintosh. It is an impossible structure to define. It is influenced by Holland, you can see the cross-step gables, and by France. It defies most people's idea of architecture. It's a supreme example of architecture without architects. In fact, it was made by local workers, joiners, plumbers, stonemasons, who knew exactly about the lie of the land and the angle of the hill and the importance of these trees, and we've got the windows right and the doors. There is no one can explain the mystery of that space. I wish I had time to give a series of lectures on the 655 castles which exist in Scotland. Proof positive that the Scots should have a very great visual language at their disposal. Unfortunately, the 20th century has worked its havoc, and the Scots have no sense, as far as I can see, of how to build better cities than the ones we're landing with. And when I came here, I realised our problems are your problems. We are not quite sure what is the next step in the building of our buildings, or our cities, our dwellings, our places to shelter our communities. And this is one of the great problems, I think, that will have to be faced over the next 20 years. I like this landscape of Edinburgh, and I want you to know that if it relates to the world of King Arthur, It extends far beyond Edinburgh to another hill dominated by the spirit of Arthur. And this hill is a St. Michael Hill. Most of the important key points of energy in the British Isles are marked by the name St. Michael. Who was St. Michael? I suppose, when I think of it, he was the James Bond or the Kojak or whatever of his time, and he had a very much more important force than the New York City Police. He was more important than Starsky and Hutch combined. And he was sent there to deal with the power that existed on that hill. Well, I don't think he has managed, whoever he was, to deal with the power of that hill, because it's still there. And I believe the power of that hill is the power of the earth spirit. She who controls the spaceship Earth, which is our habitation. She who is the spirit of art. She who represents psyche, breath. She who represents the womb. She who represents all poetry. She who is the opposite of techne, and the power of the male principle, which completely controls the 20th century. By the way, I am not advocating a complete takeover by psyche. That would be a disaster. But certainly no more of a disaster than the world at this moment, dominated by techne. But what was happening on that hill? Mankind knew how to say thank you to the goddess. And in this act of homage, of understanding to the very earth spirit, something beautiful arose. And now I'm going to show you how she is blessed in the English landscape. I adore the English landscape because it is for me a work of art. This is my favorite sculpture. You see this hedge? This hedge is a 600-year-old contemporary artwork. The Americans would say it was land art. I would not be so foolish as to imagine that it was land art or anything else. It is a hedge. And in this hedge, and you know it is 600 years, there is a fantastic variety of life, of plants and shrubs and trees and animals. And look how it is structured. And it follows a path, which at one time was a track made by animals and later by pilgrims and traveling scholars, to a point which dominates the landscape, and which, I'm not going to surprise you if I tell you, is defined by St. Michael. St. Michael, once again, representing whatever it was that is the male principle, the male activity, paying homage to something older than Christianity, something older than Michael. Now, who is this force? Well, I like to define him rather more as Lugus, or Lugh, who is the Celtic god of the sacred place. Lugus is the shining one, he who controls the force of Lammas Tide, the Lammas Fair. The Lammas Tide is the feast when the earth has given all, it's the end of the summer. Who is Lugus? Lugus to the Celts, he was better than Mercury. He was more than male, he was the balance of male and female, and he made all things well, the supreme artist craftsman. I think you'll find that the Lammas Tide is celebrated very beautifully in that parish. And I think of the British and the fact that they have the most avant-garde large pieces of sculpture in the world, even bigger than anything I saw in America. This is a very avant-garde piece. You can see the horse. This is a part of it close to. It's called the Uffington White Horse. Here is where St. Michael or St. George, who's really the same person, killed the dragon. You always wonder where St. George killed the dragon. It was on that flat top mountain. You know that he killed the dragon there because you can see where the blood was spilt and the grass cannot grow upon the bloodstains. Perfectly straightforward explanation which the people of Uffington would offer to you, and if you argued with them, they would not buy you another beer. I once watched an American argue with a group of villagers, and they definitely decided not to buy him another beer. But isn't that a splendid thing? And thank heavens they couldn't get it inside the Tate. They had to leave it where it was. Now you tell me how that is drawn year after year, generation after generation, so splendidly. It is more than a horse. It is the symbol of the white dragon and the goddess Pomona and the goddess of the white horse. You know there are 550 pubs in England named after the white horse. And no one asks why. They are always in one part of the country, and there are another 400 pubs named after the black horse. I'm not going to tell you why, but I'm going to ask you to wake up in the middle of the night and try and find an answer. Now, isn't that a marvelous thought? How lucky the British are to have all that art working for them without the help of the English Arts Council. Anyway, this is a drawing of one of the largest horses. He is called the Langport horse or the Langport dog. He is 5 miles long.
How long?
5 miles. Mm-hmm. You have heard of the Nazca lines in Peru. This is the British equivalent. It is made out of the rivers, streams, ancient tracks, and field systems, which have almost disappeared. At the very snout, there is a church named after St. Michael. Right at the nose. I don't want to disappoint you or worry you, but at the tail, there is a village called Wag.
Called what?
Wag.
What does that mean?
A dog wags his tail. Now, I know that people would say it's not important, but I think it is, and Catherine Maltwood learned how to fly, and she was a girl from British Columbia, and she was 50 years of age when she came over, and she said, I know that there are the great drawings of the zodiac signs all around the great hill of Glastonbury. And what is Glastonbury? It is the site of the Holy Grail. Wow. But how wonderful it is that that dog exists, and one of the finest young artists in England that I know, highly intelligent young man who knows how to draw, has spent 4 years of his life revealing it in that form. By the way, there are 14 sacred wells in that space, and in that space also is the grave of Arthur. And that's only one of the figures. There are 11 other figures. But we won't bother with that too much. I can't really deal with this kind of art, which costs far too much money. It's way beyond whatever could be paid by all the oil companies in the North Sea. I'm really thinking of the best portrait I can think of Lugus. I said he was the god of the high place. This is the largest drawing in the world, 231 feet tall, and he stands opening the gates of heaven, or more than that, defining his love, his understanding, and his regard for the goddess. He is the male principle at that point of balance who knows exactly how to reveal himself and how perfectly he is drawn there. Did you know that I spent my entire time as an art student without anyone pointing out the reality of that figure? Can you tell me how that figure is revealed even to this day? Why it is still like that? Do you know how many figures there were on the South Downs? There must have been over 200.
On the what?
The white cliffs of the south coast. It's a 6th century figure. Thank heavens he's there. I do believe that it's beyond human explanation. Sorry?
Can I put a question?
Sure.
Why can't he just be two spears or something like that?
Could be. Yeah. Could be. It depends on how one wants to think about it. But I don't know. It's not a gesture, a warlike gesture, is it? It's not really a warlike gesture. A very strange gesture. Maybe he's opening the doors or something, I don't know.
Yeah, but the top of his fingers is going around.
Yes, that's true. Well, I do believe he's there to let us know that not everything happened in the last 100 years. Anyway, these are the followers of the god Lugus, and they are celebrating Lammas Time. And this is not a group of performance artists supported by the English Arts Council. They are the villagers of Abbot Bromley, and they're involved in a dance involving the horns, which have never in 800 years left the parish of Abbot Bromley. How do you pay for it? Who is the audience? The audience at every single point in the year when they have to celebrate Lugus, appears as the villagers. Who are the performers? They are the villagers. What is in the center? That is a hobby horse. Who is she? That is Maid Marian. But not Maid Marian, the consort of Robin Hood, but Maid Marian, who is Mary, she who makes England merry. Have you ever asked why England is called Merry England? And what does making merry mean? Mary is, in fact, she who predates the Virgin Mother. She is responsible for the rioting in the 14th century in Edinburgh when all the students paid homage to her. Regard what's going on there. And look here at something even more dangerous. What are these creatures doing? Can you imagine? They are the villagers of Marshfield. They're involved in a very abstract and powerful form of performance. Again, they are doing it around the time of the Lugus festival, the Lammas Tide. My heavens, the spirit of Lugus still lives, despite the Arts Council. This is my favorite art school. The reason is they had a very good graphic art department, and they produced, apart from anything else, the Book of Kells. And the reason I love it is that they have a habit in these days, unlike most American art schools, of burying the faculty and the student body on campus. Notice, by the way, that in art schools they don't bury anyone anywhere near the school, for fear of contamination, I suppose. This is Glendalough, the ancient Celtic university, which is one of the great seats of learning in the world, which produced hundreds of saints and scholars. It is a rather remarkable structure dominated by a round tower. The graves are extremely important because they are linked to a whole pattern and complex of temples stretching out from this sacred valley. And now, there you see in the Abbey of Iona the image of the goddess. This was pointed out to me by Lord MacLeod of Tunery, who is the founder of the Iona community. You notice that she is an erotic, sensual creature, predating the Virgin Mother. She is called the Sheila na Gig, which is in Gaelic, it means the goddess of the dawn. And if you investigate the landscape around Edinburgh, about 150 miles around, you see in the churches, as in this one on Harris, you will find that she's there. The spirit and the flesh together. Not within the pages of Playboy, but within the structure of the church itself. Now, this creature has been very badly treated by the Protestant Reformation, I suppose, who went about getting rid of her. But in the more remote areas, you'll still find this powerful effigy. And in fact, I think that it'll be found all over England. And what is it? It is the power of the female, which is the power of procreation. It is the earth spirit honored. It is something which is so religious that it obviously deserves to be somehow a part of the fabric of a Christian church. And it's linked to these great and extraordinary temples, which are the megalithic lunar observatories, which have begun to change people's consciousness about the exact nature of the cultural heritage of the British Isles. This is a complex on the island of Lewis, which is something like 50 square miles. There are about 30 or 40 temples all linked. This is the center one, and it's based, according to Professor Alexander Tom, on the Pythagorean relation. It's built on the same plan as the Great Pyramids and Shah Cathedral, etc. So it is a continuing understanding of the forces that govern nature. The extraordinary thing about this is that it has been left, until fairly recently, in the hands of archaeologists. Can you imagine that? And all they can do is tie little labels around whatever they find and put them in museums. Well, obviously, it's still working as a, well, whatever it is,
as an observatory, as a
computer, as whatever you like to call it, as a temple. More than that, as a marker, defining that space as an extraordinarily powerful space in relation to the sun and the moon and the stars. Now, north of this, a very short distance away, there's an even more powerful manifestation of visual language, and it is the ring of Broga.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
I would give this first prize to the next documenter, wouldn't you say, please? It deserves rather more than what Robert Morris was about. Now, how did it come about? Is it art? Is it science? Can we even use the word art? I don't think we can. Anyway, within this space, and it's such an enormous space, I really don't know what to do with it, I've decided that the DeMarco Gallery should invite artists to spend some time considering the implications. And this is the DeMarco Gallery Sculpture Park. I must apologize, it's such a tiny little space, but it's the best we can do. And it was offered to us by the chap who's the caretaker for this house, who's got many responsibilities because it's filled with Rembrandt and Rembrandtos. His name is Lord Linlithgow. He doesn't know what to do with the park, and I can always tell him what to do with it. Give it to some poor, unfortunate sculptor from South Africa who says, I'd like to make a sculpture in relation to the summer equinox, and can it be 6 miles long? So there you are. Art has begun to be in some way related to this space which I was trying to talk about. Now, this is the work of the head of sculpture of the California College of Arts, a Jewish, English, American sculptor with tremendous sensitivity. And this is a piece which is the only part of the Sutro Baths in San Francisco which exists. The Sutro Baths were the most important baths in America before the earthquake in San Francisco. The only thing left is this pump house. I dare tell you what he's written on either side, and I dare tell you what would happen if you actually reach that threshold. Maybe I should just quote one thing to you. If I could just, three or four words, and I don't see why we shouldn't just linger on what he's written. No one knows why this building was put here to stare like a blind calendar to the restless tides, nor why in such a precarious place, far from the gay safety of the baths. It goes nowhere, contains nothing. When the baths fell to ruin, this building stirred and began to wait. And what this artist did not know was that on a rocky coastline, 6,000 miles distant, built at the time of the Celts, pre-Renaissance, there existed this structure known as St. Govan's Chapel. Who was St. Govan? St. Govan was the Christianized version of Gawain, who is the Green Knight, he who found the Holy Grail. Imagine what happened when I showed this. This poor sculptor, he had a nervous breakdown. But of course, it only proves that the most avant-garde art you can think of in our time is going to look amazingly like the oldest artifacts created by man.